Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks Podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hey, welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com. And today, get ready to put on your thinking caps as we speak with Paul Gerard about his new model of testing. But first, let's hear it for our awesome sponsor, Sauce Labs. Today's episode is sponsored by Sauce Labs. Sauce Labs makes test automation awesome. Sauce's cloud-based Selenium Grid helps developers test web and mobile apps across more than 400 browser and OS platforms. Sauce also supports Appium and popular JavaScript unit testing frameworks and integrates with all the top programming languages, test frameworks, and CI systems. With built-in video recording, debugging tools, and secure tunneling for firewall testing, Sauce helps you ship better software faster. Sign up at saucelabs.com with promo code TESTTALKS14 and get 20 hours of automated testing for free. Hey, Paul, welcome to Test Talks.
Thank you.
So before we get started, could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
So my background is as in education. I did an engineering degree, and as a kid, I was growing up, my dad was an engineer, and he was kind of good with his hands. And I used to sort of almost demand construction kits and stuff. I tended to make and break things as a kid with kind of some alacrity. And as I did an engineering degree, I got into engineering, and I thought that would be my future. But very quickly, the first day of my first job, there was no work in the office, consulting engineer's office, and they said, "We've just had this computer delivered. Here are the manuals. Go and have a play. Tell us what we can do with it." And kind of, I only did a bit of engineering from then on, but pretty much I was dropped into software almost from the first day of my working life, unintentionally. And from there, I went from an engineering company writing code to an engineering company that had a software department, and from there drifted into software businesses completely and eventually into testing. But it wasn't an intentional kind of journey, I have to say. But here I am.
Awesome. Yeah, sounds typical. Most testers I meet didn't start out saying, "I'm going to be a tester, a software tester."
I think so. Right. I mean, I think half the guys out there who are doing the job started off in a business that needed some acceptance testing or, you know, validation of some internal product or software, and found it either more interesting or maybe it pays better.
So, Paul, I know you have a lot of experience. Your site is full of information of different papers. You've given a lot of talks. Today, I want to start off by focusing on your new model for testing. At a high level, how would you explain what your new model for testing is?
It's kind of born out of a frustration with the way testing is discussed and I guess understood as well. I have in my kind of bones a sense that testing is fundamental, the same for everybody. That is, you get a whole bunch of guys going to a testing show, maybe 1,000 people, and then there are 300 different views on how testing should be done. And you think, well, that's kind of good for kind of having good, interesting discussions, but it's bad in terms of understanding where the industry is at, because there's quite deep disagreements, you know, across, as you know, how testing should be performed, whether it's planned or documented or purely exploratory or the whole certification debate. There's the should testers be competent programmers as well as competent thinkers and testers? Yeah, there's a whole lot of kind of debates over these areas. Now, I think there are some fundamental things that I think all testers could agree on. And I wrote a book called Testers Pocketbook some years ago, which was the sense of trying to identify the core questions of testing that all testers should be familiar with, the core disciplines, if you like. Now, the model, as is more recent, and I started working on this kind of last summer, is really to try and take that thinking that there are some core activities that all testers perform at their deepest, to take that and say, well, what are the core thinking processes that we all have to go through as individuals who test? So there's that angle. There's also the angle that testers are kind of over possessive of what we call software testing. And by that I mean testing conferences tend to mostly have testers attending and developer conferences. I've mostly developers and project managers, whatever. You know, we're a very siloed kind of industry, and testing's no different. And yet, developers and BAs, operations guys, all these people test, and obviously end users, you know, all these guys test to varying degrees of formality and to varying degrees of technical depth, if you like, whether they're looking at a user interface or a business process or whether they're looking deep into very complex code. All these people test. And so I want to move away from testing is owned by testers, because I think it's kind of a dead end to think of testing in that way. You know, I think we've got to broaden our perspective of what testing really is. It's not a role, it's an activity with a deliverable, you know, and those deliverables vary, and the goals of testing at various stages done by various people vary. It's a much bigger subject than you might imagine if you talk to some people who, you know, maybe the certification schemes, or maybe, you know, some of the consultants out there who promote very specific ways of doing the job. It's too narrow a focus. And so I've tried to get down to the real nitty-gritty, and that's what the model fundamentally is about, to try and understand and to try and have more cogent or competent discussions about what we do as testers and also what we do in common. And there's not enough discussion about what we do in common. There's too much discussion, I think, on what our different perspectives are, whether we come at things from a formal or an informal or an exploratory perspective, or whether we're a user or a system tester or a developer or a BA, for that matter. So the purpose of the model is to try and identify the core thinking activities, if you like. Not to say there's a process that could be described in great detail and mapped out in glorious technicolor, but rather there is a collection of activities that are going on in our minds as we test, as we think about testing, as we do it hands-on.
I definitely agree with you. I see a lot of times it's either manual versus automation testers. There's a testers versus developers. There's all these this or that. There's these faults, I think, choices that we have to make. And I think this model helps us kind of break it down into thoughts or concepts that we can use that are not specific to a person or a role, but actually is part of an organization that it's like practices that everyone buys into and participates in.
Yeah. I think so. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying this is the final chapter in our understanding of testing. That's not the purpose of it at all. It's a proposal, like everything I've written in the past, is a proposal for how we might think about things. So its purpose is not to pin down exactly how testing should be done. It's not a set of practices. It's a collection of activities or processes that are going on in our heads. But by processes, I don't mean they've got defined inputs and outputs with a procedure to follow and an entry and exit criteria and all that kind of stuff. I don't mean at that level. One of them is inquiring. Now, inquiring could mean many different things to different people and in different circumstances. So, but inquiring, finding out what we, you know, obtaining knowledge from our sources of knowledge, whether it's a user or a document or a standard or a specification or it's our own experience. I don't know and I don't care. Those are all kind of logistical things. The sources of knowledge have to be questioned in order to get the knowledge we need to build models in our minds of how a system might be meant to work, and thereby to create some meaningful tests against that model. So they are, in some respects, they're very vague activities, but I think people would understand them as they happen in their own experience. So although it seems like a very, almost an intellectual exercise to identify these thought processes, each one of them relates directly to your human experience as you go through the process of understanding what the problem is, understanding how to simplify the complexity of a requirement or the behavior of a system, and understanding how to extract information from models to derive good tests, and so on. So it's a trigger for a thought process, almost. Maybe that's what I should call them. They're just little signposts for the things that ought to be on your mind at a certain stage in your thinking. You can use that to identify perhaps where you could improve or learn more about your profession, I think.
Awesome. Now, you have a great webinar on this whole topic with slides on it, so I will include that in the show notes so people can follow along. So I just want to dive down a little bit more deeper, because you talked about logistics, saying that a lot of times we get things mixed up with logistics, and that's part of the problem you've been seeing in testing. Can we discuss that a little bit more? What do you mean by that? Logistics is not the same as testing.
Okay, so if my task, looking back a few years, if my task was to identify the critical thought processes of testing, you need to remove all the clutter of stuff that doesn't actually assist or support those thought processes. By logistics, and let me just say that these are the things that I would call logistics. So whether I write a test down before I run it, or whether I just think of a test and execute it on the spot, I don't care. The thought process of designing that test is the same, regardless of where you get your information from, or whether you capture it in a documentary format, or you just store it in a few neurons in your brain. I don't care. That's logistics. I don't care whether we're working in a waterfall environment in stages and kind of larger scale project, if you like, or an agile project where things are much more dynamic, ad hoc, and proactive, if you like. I don't care whether we're using a tool to drive our tests, or whether we use our hands, or whether we use our voice and our ears, or our feet, or whatever, you know, or we ask someone else to do it on our behalf. These are logistical decisions to be made. They're very important, and I care about them in the sense that they're part of the overall activity of getting the job done. But in terms of the pure thought process, they're irrelevant. So by identifying what is a logistical activity, it's not part of the thought process. My argument is, well, let's remove that from the equation, remove that entirely from the scope of, you know, the system we're looking at, which is the thinking thought system, to simplify the problem, which is, what the hell do we have to go through in our minds in order to do the job we call testing? So logistics, you know, are critically important in many environments, but they're not germane to the thinking process, the thinking tools that we use to get the job done. So that's what I mean by logistics. They get in the way. Now, one of the outcomes of the model, which we might touch on later, but I'll mention it here, is it would appear to me that when you start identifying whether you are documenting, planning, working in stages, using tools or not tools, you're sketching out basically the content of what would be very closely, very similar to the certification syllabus. And my argument, and this was kind of a revelation that came to me some months ago, is that one of the problems we've got with the certification schemes is they are almost entirely about logistics, which are different wherever you go. So, whereas I think the thought processes potentially are, there is a pattern, and it's that pattern I'm really interested in. So that was an outcome, an interesting little gem that came out of this, is that I honestly think that the certification schemes are what they are because they don't cover the thought processes, they cover the logistics. They don't actually do the useful stuff. And so my argument against certification is not that it's useless. That's absolutely not the case. But they're not going to make you a better tester, you know. And it's not because of the examination or the teaching process or whatever. It's about they're not the scope of the syllabus of the certification schemes is not about the core thinking tools we need as testers. And that's why I think certification is of some value, but limited.
What are these key signposts we can look to help us do better testing?
Well, I think my starting point with the model was I didn't just sort of sit with a blank piece of paper and sketch it all out in an afternoon, although in some respects it came out very quickly. I mean, this has been coming out of through about 5 or 6 years, I have to say, but I never put pen to paper until kind of recently. The core split in our personality almost in terms of what we do as testers is we do two core things. We do exploration of our sources of knowledge to build models, to understand the problem, to simplify what we see as a terribly complex challenge, you know, to test. So we explore and model, and that is the first kind of core process. And the second core process is the process of test design derived from models and the execution of tests and interpretation, reporting, logging, and so on and so forth. The model in a nutshell is we explore sources of knowledge to create test models to inform our testing. And that's, in a one-liner, what the model is about. You know, it's about exploration of source of knowledge, creating test models from which we derive tests that have meaning. Now, how can we sort of improve our testing by looking at the world in this way, you know, the testing world, let's say? Well, you have to go to the next level. So the whole process of exploration has several sub-processes, let's call it. And the process of testing, as I have called it, has several sub-processes too. And I think there are 10. There may be more, there may be less. I'm open to suggestion on that. But these 10 kind of areas of thinking, if you like, I think give you the signpost to the skills that will be required by a tester. You know, the initial skill is inquiry, you know, seeking knowledge from our sources, whether they are documents or people or our own experience or the system under test or the system to be replaced, might be our Oracle perhaps. We need to extract knowledge from these sources in order to understand the problem at hand. And we use that inquiry process to as a source in order for us to model the problem. So inquiring is a core thought process, and inquiring throws up several, you know, notable skills areas. Like, again, I'm not an expert in all these things because we're covering most of software engineering and these things. but inquiry is about, well, with people, it's kind of interviewing skills and asking context-free questions and being non-judgmental, you know, in order to extract out of other people's heads the knowledge which will give you an insight as to what the system is meant to do. Reading a specification isn't a case of just starting at the first word, reading 200,000 words, and then say, yes, I understand it. There's kind of speed reading and scanning techniques, and then there are almost analytical techniques in order to read things in a much more focused and structured way. And in fact, as we read, we model them in our minds anyway, and we're building mental models almost every second of the day. Well, I think that actually is true. You know, every second of the day, and perhaps fractions of a second of a day, we are creating models of our world in order to understand it. So I talk as if, you know, modeling is just about analyzing requirements or specs or an existing system or the behavior that we just experienced a moment ago when I tried something out on a system. Modeling is actually a core, let me put it this way, our brains are superb modeling engines. And the analogy I would use would be that if I walk from my study to the kitchen to go and get a glass of water, I've got to negotiate a flight of stairs, I've got to open a couple of doors, I've got to turn a tap on, I've got to get a glass, I've got to hold it stable so it fills up, I've got to put it to my mouth and drink without spilling it all down my chest, you know. Now, all those activities require me to understand how to control the collection of structural elements in my body, my bone, my skeleton, and the hundreds of muscles that control the relative movements of each one of those. And I've got to do this in a way that I don't fall down the stairs, that I don't flood the kitchen, that I don't turn the wrong tap on and scald myself, that I don't dribble all the water down my chin. The number of calculations my brain is doing, and yours and everybody else who can move around and, you know, act a normal life, our brains are superb engines at modeling and calculating these models at incredible speeds. Because as I take every step down the stairs, I'm calculating and recalibrating and recalculating the position of everything in my environment so I don't fall down the stairs and break my neck. You know, that's an incredible achievement to be able to do that. So those modeling skills that we have as an innate skill are exactly the same skills in a kind of an abstract way rather than a physical way, I have to say. But in an abstract way, those skills are exactly the same when we model the behavior of a system with a view to creating good tests. So modeling is at the core of our existence as human beings, and it's at the core of testing. And I don't think anyone would dispute that. What those models are, mostly, are unknown. They are internalized in our minds. And if you like, the single skill that we don't practice enough would be this idea of using our brains to model our world and model our systems in order to create good tests. That was a rather long-winded answer. Sorry, you've got me excited on my favorite subject.
Awesome. So, Paul, I thought what was interesting is also when you said these areas of thinking for testers are the same that developers use, if I understood correctly. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if it's true or not.
Okay.
I have a strong suspicion that actually they are pretty damn similar. I'm not saying people think the same, like a tester and developer think the same thoughts. Absolutely not. But there's a process in each where a tester models a world in order to understand, to simplify the problem, to identify things to cover in tests. A developer models a requirement, or the world, if you like, models the requirement in order to better understand what features they need to create, how those features should behave in a range of circumstances, and what outcomes should be obtained from those features. So I think in terms of the modeling activity, developers and testers have that as a core skill. They have to. The goal of a tester is to understand and to tease out ways of exercising a system to give confidence that it works, or to find bugs, or to demonstrate it works the same way as it did yesterday, whatever. A developer has a slightly different goal. Their goal is to try and create the code. But the modeling process, I think, is the same. Now, I say this with some confidence, but also huge arrogance, because I am a developer, really. So don't tell anybody, but I am actually a developer at heart. And I can't distinguish the thought processes in my head when I'm trying to write a few lines of code to achieve something and how I would approach the testing of those few lines of code. I struggled with it a little bit. And I said, well, they must be different. And then the more I thought about it, the more I kind of tried to practice what I preach, I thought, no, it's the same process. The outcome might be different, but the thinking tools we have are, I think, they're the same. Now, one of the benefits of that, potentially, is when a developer talks to a tester, or a tester talks to a developer, let's do it that way, and the tester asks the question, you know, what's this software meant to do? The developer might initially start talking in terms of lines of code, but we really want him to talk in terms of the models he's built. You know, how does he visualize the code he's written? In the same way, I think the tester, rather than talk about concrete test cases, should be thinking about, this is the way I see the flow of control in the piece of software. This is how I visualize it. Maybe we should get in front of the whiteboard and share our damn models. Wouldn't we get on better if we did did that? You know, so it seems to me that if a tester goes to a developer and says, I've got this little picture, this thing that looks like some kind of creepy crawly insect, this model of the way I think, how much of this is familiar to you? I think you'd find the developer would say that most of it would be common. They'd see some of it as being quite familiar. And I've got no proof of this. I've got no evidence. I've got no statistics or data. I just think it kind of makes sense. It's intuitively kind of sensible to me. Now, I know that's not a safe bet, obviously. But if you've got a better idea, I'd like to see it.
Right. No, I think I definitely agree with you. And I think, you know, I don't know if you agree with this, that I think things like behavior-driven development may help. Yeah. It sounds kind of like what you're discussing here, where developers and testers, and actually everyone on the team, is talking in the language as a user to help collaborate and discuss what it is they're actually developing.
Yeah.
Is that something that could help teams with this model, is to use techniques like BDD?
I think so. I learned about test models 25 years ago from a book by Boris Beiser, who talks about models, not extensively, but as soon as I read that, I thought, as a developer who really hadn't thought about testing in the past, because I did start off life as a developer and not a tester, it kind of all became clear that, okay, models are the thing. Now, time passed, and I talked about models without ever sort of having any deep thoughts about them. And then I got involved with BDD and this notion of collaboration with a view to capturing examples, which is what stories summarize. They identify, you know, if you think of the Gherkin kind of language, you get as AI want, so that, you know, that identifies the feature, it's a placeholder for the feature. It's the scenarios which represent concrete examples of something in use. And the thing is, like, when you think about it as a model, well, the story is a model of the system or some feature of the system. And the scenarios in the BDD kind of perspective represent examples of that feature in use. So if you get those kind of stories on a whiteboard or just written down and people can share and discuss, you can then have fascinating conversations where, you know, the tester can challenge the analyst, and so can the developer, of course, can challenge the user or the analyst who's written the story by saying, well, I've just thought of a new scenario. How does your feature cope with this? In fact, I know it won't cope because I've seen the requirement and this example conflicts with the definition of the requirement in a document or the way you've described it to me and shared it with me. So we use the scenarios as challenges. Now, the thing about that is those challenges map directly to what I've called challenging in the new model. So when someone writes a requirement, as a tester, I instantly think of examples where, I wonder what would happen if, you know. And so those challenges, you can feed back and say, well, this is how you build a richer picture of the requirement through example. But also it's your opportunity to challenge the thinking of the team, of the developer, of the BA, of the user, of the product owner, and of the tester.
The reason why I brought up BDD also is I think you also brought a really good point up in the webinar about after development, it should be called rework, not testing. And I think if we start doing practices like BDD, when we're talking about things before code is written, that this could help with that type of thinking. And I really struck me that, you know, if we can start saying after development is done, if we have to do any sort of testing, that it's not testing, that it's actually rework. Can you expand upon that a little?
I mean, for how many years have testing consultants said we should bring testing forward, you know, the life cycle, we should test early, test often, and so on and so forth. These are mantras that have been around for as long as I've been in the business, and that's, you know, since the early 90s. So with that thought, you say, well, how do we make that happen? Because until Agile, you know, came along, and these new shorter kind of feedback loops and processes came along, the possibility of bringing testing upstream was virtually impossible. I mean, the testers didn't get hired until the system was nearly delivered from development. You know, that's just when you got involved. It was far too damn late. Now, having said that, the notion of the challenges that we see as testers, testing not being taken seriously, testing getting in the way, testing being expensive, it's all taking too damn long. Why does testing take so long? Well, if the developers didn't put the damn bugs in, it wouldn't take anywhere near as long. Maybe we'd get through it, you know, it would take the third of the length of time it might take, you know, in a system test. And that's a number I've used many years, and it's not a million miles away on most waterfall projects. So wait a minute, if we change the perception of what the test phase is from being an activity without a deliverable, which is what most people's perception of testing is, it's just a barrier to delivery, if you like. Change that from it's rework, which actually, in many respects, you know, the bugs we find as testers have to be worked on. It's a collaborative effort between testers and developers to finish the job. If we change that label to rework, the perspective of what the testers doing are, well, we're finding the rework for the developers to do. The obvious question arises, well, then how do we reduce this, you know, ferociously bad traumatic delay at the end of most, you know, certainly most medium and large projects? How do we eliminate or reduce this thing called rework? Well, the tester's answer would be, well, get me involved a bit earlier. Let me find the bugs as we put them in, or better still, prevent them if that's possible. It's not always possible, of course. But the whole notion of shift left, which, you know, is gaining kind of momentum in many organizations, to support the shift left idea, you take the position of, well, we're going to eliminate the test phase. That is, we're going to eliminate rework if that's at all possible. And how do we do that? We have to put the pursuit of defects, bugs, errors, whatever you call them, we have to put the pursuit of bugs as close to the creation of those bugs as we can. And essentially, that means aligning testing with development and putting the testing activities, identifying the testing activities within the development process. So it may be that we don't have testers anymore, independent testers. And in extremis, that, you know, that seems to be how some companies are beginning to operate, and with success. So the developer, at one extreme, the developer might own the problem of finding the bugs because he knows he's not got a safety net, or she knows there's no safety net after they ship. Therefore, they have to take testing more seriously. And they have to understand their code better. They have to understand the requirements better. They have to validate, verify, test the code as they write it. And maybe a TDD or BDD approach will help them do that in a more effective way. I'm not saying that's the only way of doing it, but you know, you must use TDD to be shift left or BDD to be to shift left. But the developer must know their code intimately, not just from the point of how they've written it and the structure, but also from its behavior. They must know what their code is capable of before they ship. Too many developers, I think, regrettably, ship code they think works, but they think it works simply because the model in their mind is a perfect model and they think they've implemented it perfectly in the code. And that's not usually the case.
You actually hit on one of the points I was going to ask next about shift left. This seems like there's a movement now towards the shift left type approach to software development. For the people that don't know, how would you explain really quickly what shift left is? Is it starting testing as early in the development lifecycle as possible? Is that how you would explain it?
In a word, yes. Okay. That's not the answer you want, but I mean, a little bit of history perhaps is required. I think, you know, with Agile, you know, came 10, 12, 14 years ago, whenever, you know, it started coming out as emerging as a credible approach. TDD came out pretty soon as part of that overall process. And I don't think TDD in some respects is that new. I mean, I remember, you know, my first Eurostar talk in 1993, I talked about using behaviors to example requirements. I didn't talk so much about using them to drive test automation, but more to generate prototypes, if you like, to validate requirements through example and stuff like that. And apart from that, I was also involved in a testing standard, component test standard, and test first was part of that standard in effect, in that you might not write the tests before you write the code, but you certainly think about black box coverage first before you start looking at testing the code, you know, through the white box techniques. At any rate, the notion of shift left, I think, came from several perspectives. One was the testing is dead meme that was doing the rounds 3-4 years ago, whatever, you know, from, you know, the Googles and the Amazons and the eBays and these guys who have been living and breathing kind of high intensity continuous delivery. I mean, these guys were sort of saying, this is the future. Now, a lot of people were absolutely horrified at this because it didn't seem any a possible leap of faith to actually go from staged, planned project development, you know, waterfall, to continuous delivery in that way. But some companies have found that actually, if they can get control of their existing code base and the quality, that actually a continuous delivery process is possible. Now, continuous delivery depends on very high levels of automation. And as part of that, that automation happens very late in the day. It's very, you know, the automation all happens very close to the pressing the button to ship either into production or perhaps even to go live. Now, in order for that automation to do what it does, the thinking about testing has to be shifted left. So in order to have a set of automated tests that you trust validate some software and cover the key features of the software, you know, you have to have those tests in place before you press the button to release that code into a library to trigger other automated processes, ultimately to be shipped into a production or another staging or test environment, whatever it's called. So the shift left isn't about moving activities. I would strongly argue it's about moving the thinking. Now, that thinking about test might be done entirely by developers. And in some organizations, it is. Now, the developers are simply good developers, and they're good testers. Now, you might argue a good developer is also a good tester by definition, because developers have to do an awful lot of testing to do their job properly. So in some organizations, the testing is in the heads of the developers, and they do it early and they do it often. In other organizations, we have collaborative teams with a tester, a BA, whatever, the three amigos, if you like, where the thinking about testing is being done partially by the tester, who is asking challenging questions of the requirements and challenging questions of the developers, and also perhaps creating some tests. But it's not that the testing has been moved forward, it's the thinking about testing that has been moved forward. And that's why the model is geared towards trying to address this challenge of understanding what do we need to think about in order to do this test early, test often, discipline. So I'm not unduly worried about whether we use tools or do it manually or whatever. DevOps guys are obsessed about automation, and that's absolutely fine. But where does that thinking fit? And in order to understand where that thinking fits, we have to identify what that thinking is and how it aligns with the thinking about the formulation of the requirements, the design of code, and the assurance, if you like, that we need that code works and is ready for delivery.
I definitely agree this type of model is necessary, because like you said, I think more teams are moving towards the shift left approach. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, like you said, it's not one size fits all, but as long as we focus on the thoughts, how we should think about testing, we should be okay. The reason why I say this is I work for a very large company. Our developers are really kind of ingrained in the old school. So if we could get people to more focus on the thought processes that they have to do when they're developing software, rather than saying this is a testing activity, I think we might be better off. And also, I just wanted to clarify what you said earlier, because I could see getting flame emails. We're not saying that testers are going to go away, but there are companies that definitely are moving towards that there are no testers within their development teams. And that's because, like you said, they're using this new model almost of thinking about what should development be and how should it be done in a way that, you know, we're producing code that is being tested from the earliest stages on.
I think so. So certainly there was a lot of, I'm sure you remember, you know, the testing is dead meme that sort of did the rounds, and there were people who were in partial agreement and total agreement, and people who were in partial disagreement and complete objection to the whole idea. Yep. And I think that's because, well, on the one hand, on a kind of a cynical level, for example, conference speakers, because it got attention. So, yeah, let's get someone to talk about the death of testing in a room full of people whose careers apparently are coming to an end. You know, that's going to get some attention. Right. It's going to sell, you know. So taken out of context, death of testing is kind of, it's a meaningless statement because the testing is still done. You know, it's just done by different people and potentially developers, or it's done at a different time and a different place. And I think that's what Shift Left is about. It's not about moving people. It's about moving thinking. Now, a tester who is, let's say, a run-of-the-mill, give me a spec, I'll write some test plans, I'll follow my scripts, I'll log bugs, this, that, and the other, those kind of roles in some businesses are definitely under threat. Yep. There's no question. No question. And in some companies, those roles have gone. It's a fact. You know, you can dispute it if you like, but it's a fact that they've gone. But in some industries, that approach will never disappear because of the nature and the culture of the businesses creating software. So in the high integrity arena, given their fearsome demands to be transparent about what they do in organizations that have multiple stakeholders, and by multiple, it might be several companies, tens of individuals who need to have a view, to take a view on the testing, you have to write this stuff down. You have to be seen to do what you say. You have to follow a formal process. And these cultures, you know, the high integrity, you know, defense, government, and so on, they have to operate this way, these ways. And so nothing is going to be to become extinct, if that makes sense. And certainly testers and testing done, quote, by the book, unquote, is not going away anytime soon. There's plenty of businesses who have to operate this way. But I have to say that if you just do a three-day certification course and think, now I know everything I need to know about a career in test, I think those days are kind of numbered.
I definitely agree. And I've worked for companies that develop medical devices, and it's, you know, they have to be audited. So they really do have to, they try to be agile, but they still have to have these other processes in place where, you know, you do have to have a tester with a certain different type of skill set. I think yep. The best answer I've heard for something like that is from Janet Gregory, saying that testers, that they're not going away, manual testers aren't going away, but they need to be more technically aware so that they should be able to speak the language of the developer. They may not necessarily have to be programmers extraordinaires, but they should have to have, you know, a basic understanding of how to program maybe, or how to talk to developers in a way that they're able to communicate on the same level. I'm not sure if you agree with that or not, but
absolutely. Right. Again, that's a very simple answer for you. Right. I mean, I think that way because I'm a developer, right, in that respect, and I kind of feel that one of the reasons I've had in some respects, a successful career in consulting and whatever, is because I do try and stay up to date with the technology. I'm a big open source fan. I still write code. I love writing Python, you know, and so on and so forth. And I feel that I can get on with developers because I kind of talk the same language. I haven't a clue about how you write software in a .NET environment. I hate Java. You know, it's the worst. It's like it's the COBOL of the, you know, 21st century, isn't it? It's the language everyone loves to hate, and so on and so forth. So I can't write code in Java, and I used to write VB and ASP kind of software. But .NET, when .NET came along, I couldn't keep pace with it, and I just didn't stick with it. So I can't have a technical conversation at the level of code, But when a developer says he's having difficulty getting a service working, I understand what that means. I understand what a service is and what a service's purpose is. And I understand about, you know, the difference between JSON and CSV and XML and stuff like that. And because these are kind of universal things, but at a programming coding level, I can only talk with authority about Python because I'm up to date with that. And having said that, I wrote, there was a series of blog exchanges, mostly in the UK, about, you know, this question of should testers learn how to write code. And the argument for it is, as you mentioned, Janet, is very definitely you have the, some of the similar insights to developers. So you understand what their problem is as well as your own. So you can have a more, you know, a reasonable conversation, you know, and also you can also spot when you're having the, you know, the wool pulled over your eyes, you know, so you can spot a fake, you know, so it's a positive thing. What was really interesting was there were individuals who thought, well, if I learn how to code, I'll be infected with the same programmers don't care about testing mentality that they are all infected with. And I thought, wait a minute, this is so retrograde. You know, it's the wrong thing. It's the wrong thing to do. Anyway, I felt so strongly about this. I wrote a little book on Python. I started to write it and call it Python for Testers. It's a little pocketbook like the black one. And it's 100 pages or so, and it's not very long, about 13,000 words, I think, seem to remember. And I started writing it as Python for Testers. And then I thought, if I was writing this for developers, would I write it any differently? And I thought, no. So I changed it to Lean Python because it's a little pocketbook. It's the code. It basically summarizes the code and the constructs and the language elements that I know as a developer. And I've written perhaps, I don't know how many thousand, 30, 40, 50,000 lines of code, I don't know, in Python. So I understand the language reasonably well, but I only know a quarter of the language. And so what I wrote was a book that was much more compact than you'd expect to see in a reference book. To me, learning code is only a positive thing, you know? Yep. It can't hurt you. I think Homer Simpson was there's a quote with the Homer where every time I learn something new, something else falls out the back of my head. You know what I mean? I don't buy that. You know, knowledge only adds, it doesn't subtract. You know, you can't learn something and then say I'm a more foolish person having learned something. That doesn't compute, does it?
Right. You know? I definitely agree with that philosophy. I love to learn, always learning, and I think that's a sign of a good tester. They usually are the people that are curious and always trying to learn more.
I think so. I mean, I think there's a lot, but having said that, there's a lot made of, you know, testers who learn this, that, and the other. I'm sorry, it's a life skill. A human being who learns is a good human being. As soon as you stop learning, you might as well not be on the planet anymore. I don't mean that's not an argument for euthanasia or anything like that. It's an argument for saying you become a rather boring person.
Yes, absolutely.
You've got to move on, you know. You've got to keep swimming or you drown, you know, like a shark, you know. If you stop swimming, you stop learning, you stagnate.
Yep.
And for as long as I'm alive and capable, I'll keep reading and trying to write code and picking up Raspberry Pis and mucking about with technology. I'll keep going.
Awesome. Same here. Are there any resources or books that you recommend to someone to get up to speed with testing or with development?
Ooh. Well, there's the usual candidates, you know, for testing books. And I was asked this a little while ago, and I thought, all the popular books are well known, and you know them as well as I do, and all, I guess, your listeners will know them all as well. So I try and suggest books that are less likely to have been read by the testing and development community as well. And I'm trying to think of a few. I made a list. Maybe I should send you the list. Maybe you could reference it. I did a blog. I'll do it that way. I mean, off the top of my head, one of them, it's a book by John von Neumann. It's a book about game theory and the mathematics of decision making with uncertain data. Now, to me, that's exactly the realm we are in with testing. We've got to make decisions with uncertain data. And what the beauty of that book is by John von Neumann, and you need a master's degree to understand it, and I have to say, of course, I haven't read it either. I got it very cheaply. All I'm trying to say is when we have the data, the mathematics is all ready and waiting for us to make those decisions. And that's the crux of it. It's that we all know it's hard to make decisions with uncertain data, but we mustn't forget that all of physics, whatever, started off with uncertainty. You know, we understood the concept of heat and cold before we understood the concept of temperature. Mm. We understand the hot and cold of risk, but we don't know how to quantify it yet. And I think it's the same thing. At some point, and we've got the mathematics for this stuff already, we just haven't got the data or the trustworthy data. So all I'm trying to say is we're very early in this game. We're very, very immature. And so the day might come when we're in a better place to use the data and apply mathematics to what we do. And I just think we shouldn't give up on that. But we're nowhere near yet.
Okay, Paul. So before we go, is there one piece of actionable advice you can give someone to help them with their new modeling testing efforts? And how could someone find out more about you or contact you?
I would argue, given I've written a book, please read it. So I think you said you had difficulty finding the Tester's Pocketbook.
Yes, that book. Yes.
It is available. If you do a search on Google, there's a site called thetesterspocketbook.com, which you can buy it there. There's also a Lean Pub version of it. So it's an ebook as well. It costs a few quid. Whatever you do, for my benefit, don't buy it from Amazon because they buy it off me for less than it costs me to print them out. So, one of these things. Do not use Amazon, please.
Okay. Good point. That's the first place I go is Amazon. I'm like, oh, it's not available. I never think about Lean Pub, but maybe I. So yeah. I'll have a link to that in the show notes so people can go there directly.
Yeah, if you do a Google, it'll come up. I mean, if you look for Tester's Pocketbook, it's quite prominent on Google. How you get in touch with me? Well, the website is jarrodconsulting.com. There's links there to various things. If you look at the resources page and the papers and articles, that's where all the stuff I've written can be found, pretty much. I'm usually available, you know, through paul@jarrodconsulting.com.
Thank you, Paul, for your new model of testing awesomeness. For links to everything of value that we talked about in this episode, head on over to www.testtalks.com/42. And while you're there, make sure to click on the More Info link under our exclusive sponsor section to learn more about Sauce Lab's awesome services. Also, while you're at it, I would love it if you had a few seconds to leave a review in iTunes. Reviews go a long way in terms of exposure and helping new people come along and see that this show is worthwhile. I would really appreciate it. So head on over to iTunes and leave, hopefully, a 5-star review and leave a comment. I read every comment and your feedback helps the show get even better. So before I go, I just wanted to say this is my first episode actually recording and editing all within one program. I recently purchased Logic Pro X, which allows me to record and edit and make changes all within the same program. What I was doing before is I was recording in GarageBand, exporting it, then doing all my edits within Audacity, then exporting it out of Audacity, importing it back into GarageBand, and adding my intros and outros. But now, within Logic Pro X, I could do all that all within one application. So I just wanted to apologize if some of the edits were kind of wonky. I'm still getting used to the software, so that's why it may have been cut off at some point or the edits may not have been as clean as I like them to be. So that's it for this episode of Test Talks. As always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.